Can you guys all hear me? This isn't obnoxiously loud, is it? You're good? All right. So today, as she mentioned, I'm going to be teaching you guys. I am a graduate student, a PhD student in Dr. Melendi's lab over at UB South. And he's been teaching this lecture for the last couple years. He's kindly handed over the reins to me this year. So my task today is really to teach you guys about DNA repair in cancer. And I will also be teaching you guys about the DNA damage response because it intersects with DNA repair. So it's really important to think about that damages to our DNA, mutations, genomic instability, and translocations are all part of cancer arising. And also the tools and reagents that we use to treat cancer these days are often genotoxic. So not only is DNA damage and our ability or inability to repair that damage important for how cancer arises, it's also a really important role for how we treat cancer as well. So these are just some really good additional resources if you guys are interested, although all of the exam material will be covered in this lecture, but if you guys are really interested or have any kind of questions, these are really good go-to places. So you have the first one, which is the biology of cancer. So this talks about how cancer arises and how we treat cancer. And the second one goes directly to DNA repair and mutagenesis. So again, these are optional, you don't have to, but they are very good resources. So when we think about DNA repair and cancer, RNA and proteins can be totally degraded and resynthesized when needed. They're not always resynthesized, but they can be. And in a few cases, they are repaired. But when it comes to DNA, Francis Crick, Watson and Crick, who co-discovered the helical structure of DNA, was quoted saying, "We totally missed the possible role of enzymes in DNA repair. I later came to realize that DNA is so precious that probably many distinct repair mechanisms could exist." And this is really important. When it comes to DNA, we are very limited in the amount of DNA that we have. It's often 1 to 2 copies per genome. So therefore, when DNA is damaged, it's really not, we're not able to resynthesize DNA due to the low number of templates that we have. So when it comes to DNA, DNA repair is truly critical and vital for survival when comparing to RNA and proteins. And DNA can be repaired at the nucleotide level, or in small patches, or in larger patches, and we'll go over some of those today. So really the main focus for my talk today is DNA repair maintains the integrity of the genomic information, and this is truly critical. It maintains the integrity of the genetic information so it can be passed to subsequent cells as well as daughter cells, and then from there be used as a template to make fresh RNA and protein. So when it comes to DNA repair, all of our cells need DNA repair. DNA repair is a normal ongoing process. Constantly on a daily basis, we are being exposed to different damaging agents causing damage to our DNA. And these damaging agents can be either endogenous, so come from within our cells, such as DNA synthesis itself, which is a metabolic process, or exogenous damage, so damage coming from outside the cell, such as chemicals or radiation. So it works to damage our DNA, and it damages both the nuclear DNA and our mitochondrial DNA. So for our nuclear DNA, this is really where most of our genetic information is carried, and this is most often repaired, but if it is left unrepaired, this leads to pathology. Now, when it comes to mitochondrial DNA, if this is left unrepaired, it also leads to pathology. And a number of conditions have been recently discovered coming to mitochondrial DNA being unrepaired as the cause, but I'm not going to really talk about or focus on those today, as they're most often not related to cancer. So it's really important to think, when you have pathology, it can lead to either cancer, senescence of the cell, or apoptosis if the damage just cannot be repaired. So it's important to think of DNA repair as a normal ongoing process in a healthy cell. So constantly our cells are being braided with damage, and it's estimated that about half a million damage events occur on a daily basis, and that's a lot. So DNA repair is a constant ongoing process in healthy cells, and healthy cells is really the key word. And it's all thinking about a balance. So we have a balance between the amount of mutations that we have and the rate of repair. So in a healthy cell, you have the number of mutations are less than or equal to the rate of repair for those mutations. Now when you have a diseased cell, this is when we get a shift in the balance. So you get either an increase or decrease in the mutations, and the repair rate just cannot accommodate these. And this is when you get a diseased or unhealthy cell. And this can then lead to cancer. So again, DNA repair is a normal ongoing process in a healthy cell. So it's important to show that all organisms from bacteria to yeast to humans, pretty much everything that we have looked at, has multiple DNA repair mechanisms and multiple DNA repair pathways. And really an important thing to think about when you think about these is redundancy is key. So a lot of these, for one lesion, multiple different pathways can fix that damage. So there's a lot of overlap between the pathways for fixing that damage. But it's not necessarily true to say that all lesions can be fixed by all DNA repair pathways, because that is not true. So for example, you have a lesion, it can be fixed by pathway A or B, but it can't be repaired by pathway C or D. And hopefully you get a feel for that as we go through the lecture today. So many of these genes and proteins and repair pathways are evolutionarily conserved just because of how important they are. So they can be conserved at a nucleotide or protein level, or they can be conserved when you're looking at E. coli to humans more on a structural or functional level. So this is an old estimation, but about 150 human genes encode DNA repair proteins and many more involved in DNA damage response. Current estimates have shown that it can be up to 10% of the human genome is really attributing to the proteins involved in DNA damage response and repair, not only signaling, recognizing it, but also fixing it. And this just really shows you the importance of DNA repair and DNA damage response to the cell itself. So this is just a general overline of the topics that I will cover today. I won't necessarily go in a linear fashion when I'm going over these. But I'll be going over the types of DNA damage that occur, types of DNA repair pathways that we have to fix this DNA damage, and then hopefully I'll be tying in together DNA damage, repair, and cancer, along with some examples as well. So I'm going to start off by talking about types of DNA damage. So we have three different types. So we have error in DNA synthesis. As I said, in and of itself, it's a metabolic process. You next have spontaneous or endogenous sources, so sources coming from within the cell. And then next you have exogenous sources, so sources coming from outside the cell working to damage the DNA. And I'm going to start off by talking about errors in DNA synthesis. So as I said, it's a metabolic process, and we all know metabolic processes are not perfect. So what happens when you get an error in this in DNA synthesis? So one of the most simple things that can go wrong is you get misincorporation of the wrong nucleotide. So I'm going to be talking about DNA polymerase delta, but you can assume that most of these, the numbers will be in the same ballpark, the fidelity is about the same, but it will also be true for DNA polymerase epsilon as well. So DNA polymerase delta copies DNA with a very high fidelity, much like epsilon, and without its proofreading activity, and we'll talk about that in a couple minutes what it is, it copies DNA at a rate of one error per every 10 to the fifth base pairs. And the actual error rate may be a little bit higher than this. This is just looking at the misincorporation of deoxynucleotides. So when you're looking at the misincorporation of ribonucleotides, this may be a little bit higher, but we really don't have a way or the numbers right now to incorporate that into this number. So again, one error per 10 to the fifth base pairs. If we look at the human genome, which is about 6 from 10 to the 9th base pairs, this would account, if you do the math, for about 60,000 errors in our genome. And this is just way too many errors, way too many mutations. This would be lethal for us. So the important question is, and hopefully I'll address this throughout the whole class today, is how does our cell prevent or correct these errors to minimize the mutation rate? And really our first line of defense is proofreading within the polymerase itself. So what we have here is a general schematic of copying DNA by polymerase delta. So you have your replication complex here. And it's working to synthesize this newly synthesized strand in a 5'-3' manner. And as it's going along, you get the misincorporation of the nucleotide, and again, about every 60,000 nucleotides. And again, it's important to keep in mind this is a misincorporation of a deoxynucleotide. So once you get this misincorporation, it's actually this polymerase has a second pocket. So the first pocket is what is used to actually incorporate, catalyze that reaction, the incorporation of that nucleotide. But it also has a second pocket right after it, following it. So once you get that incorporation of the nucleotide, it then slides into the second pocket, and if the base pairing is wrong, there's actually a misfit within that pocket, and the polymerase can sense this. What happens is the polymerase then regresses, it puts that nucleotide into a third pocket, and it cleaves off that misincorporated nucleotide. And now, if you see, it's the same thing. This polymerase is now in the position to restart and incorporate the appropriate nucleotide. So it's important to note that this is a 3' to 5' exonuclease activity for this polymerase because it takes one off the end at a time. Proofreading increases the fidelity of this polymerase 100-fold. And proofreading eliminates about 99% of the mismatch mutations that are made. So it's almost perfect, but not quite. So now that we know that proofreading is so important, it's important to also note that the proofreading in genomic polymerases in eukaryotes, and it's also conserved in prokaryotes as well by a very similar mechanism. So for example, you have POL3, which is the genomic replicative polymerase, and E. coli does proofreading by a very similar mechanism. So proofreading works to decrease the mutation rate, and now we're thinking, okay, the question to ask is, does proofreading play an important role in cancer? And we really didn't have the tools to address this question properly until recently, but now using a transgenic mouse system, they were able to answer this question. So what they did is they took a homozygous point mutation, which is in the proofreading domain of DNA pol delta, which causes it to lose its proofreading activity. So when they knocked out the proofreading activity, and this is a homozygous mouse here, heterozygous up here, they then looked at the survival of the mice over time. So what they found was that within 12 months, about 70% of the mice had died, and they all died due to cancer. So this really shows the importance of that proofreading activity, and when you eliminate that proofreading activity, you're getting a bump in the mutation rate, and again, it's this whole idea of balance. So now you're shifting the balance towards cancer by increasing the mutation rate without increasing a repair mechanism to compensate for it. So this was really the first formal proof that mismatch repair is important for cancer. And what this is really telling you is if you increase the mutation rate when you get rid of that proofreading activity, the repair pathways alone that are left are not sufficient to repair it any longer. So now I'm going to talk about other pathways that are also important for eliminating mismatches in a couple slides. So now that we've gone over how important the proofreading function is, when you add that ability to the DNA polymerase delta, this increases the fidelity 100-fold of that polymerase. So again, the human genome is 6 times 10 to the 9th base pairs, so if you do the math, we've now lowered that number of errors to 600. But it's also important to ask now, how does the cell deal with these errors on top of proofreading? So our second line of defense really is mismatch repair. Mismatch repair is a class of excision repair. There are three types. So you have mismatch repair, nucleotide excision repair, and base excision repair. Now it's important to note that all three of these processes share these similar steps, but they do so by different mechanisms. So they first work to excise the damaged or mismatched DNA strand. They then come in and synthesize, based on the complementary strand, a new DNA. They then ligate the NIC to complete the synthesis. So they all share this common process, but they do so by different mechanisms. So I'll start off by talking about mismatch repair, and I'll give you an example in humans. This is a general depiction of the replication fork here, and mismatch repair is often called post-replicative repair. So how this works, and also if you look at the proteins involved, RFC and PCNA, these are proteins that are at active replicating foci. So this has really been shown that there's a good coordination between actively replicating active replication forks and MMR. So they're very closely associated. So how MMR works is you have a mu L heterodimer in green, a mu S heterodimer in red, and this creates a tetramer. This tetramer recognizes the misincorporated nucleotide, and it makes an excision. So when it makes this nick in the DNA, a vast majority of the time it is on the newly synthesized DNA strand. And how does it know which one's the newly synthesized DNA strand? Well, up until recent years, in single molecule studies, PCNA, actually, an interaction with PCNA allows this heterodimer, or this tetramer, to know which DNA strand is the newly synthesized strand. So interaction with PCNA allows it to do this. So once it makes that nick, it then recruits an exonuclease. It works to chew off that DNA. You then get gap filling by polymerase delta. And this is important because polymerase delta is the same replicative enzyme that had the first go at this DNA, right? So this is really just giving polymerase delta a second chance to incorporate the right nucleotide if proofreading didn't catch it in the first place. And then you're getting ligation by DNA ligase. So now if we take into account proofreading activity plus MMR in just one of the excision pathways, you get one error for every 10 to the 9th base pairs. So now if we're doing the math, that's about 6 errors. So this is a vast improvement, but you're still getting errors in the DNA. And this is important because errors or mutations in our DNA are what's driving evolution. But again, it's very important to keep in mind this balance idea. So some mutations or errors in the DNA allow us to evolve, but you don't want to have too many because then it can lead to cancer. So it's really a fine line and a nice balance. So this balance idea will keep coming back throughout the whole lecture today. So MMR doesn't just remove mismatch bases, it also works on insertion deletion loops, both small and intermediate size. And it's been shown that loss of MMR function can actually cause an increase or decrease in the size of these IDLs or insertion deletion loops. So what I have here, so microsatellites, which are also DNA repeats, so these can expand or contract during replication, so it can get longer or shortened during replication. So for example, a microsatellite BAC25, which is 25 nucleotides long, and it is highly rich in teeth. So this is just one example of a microsatellite. So when you look at this microsatellite from a normal patient's colon, this is what it looks like, and each peak represents a repeat. So when you take a sample from a patient that has colon cancer and you look at the colon tumor, you see that there's a shift to a much larger size of BAT25 looking, and this really suggests that there's an expansion of BAT25 in colon cancer patients. But you're not seeing the shift when you look at a breast cancer patient. So this is really suggesting that for colon cancers, the MMR and its ability to work on these insertion deletion loops may play a role in the proliferation of these cells within colon cancer, rather than just the loss of function of MMR being important. And as I'm sure most of you know, for hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer, HNPCC, this is caused by a loss of function of MMR. But the majority of colon cancers are sporadic NPCCs, are often due to somatic mutations or epigenetic silencing of genes in the MMR. So really, the proliferation of these cells and MMR's role in taking care of these IDLs or insertion deletion loops may be playing a larger role than just the loss of MMR function alone in these colon cancers. So while we're talking about different replication errors, another replication error that can occur is a break in the DNA. So I won't go into the entire pathway now because I'll be talking about it a little later, but as you're getting replication going, you can get a break in one of the strands of DNA. This can eventually lead to a double-stranded break, and this can be a real problem. So there are various ways to fix this, and I'll get into them a little bit later, but it's important to note that breaks often occur near replication forks. And it's also been shown, studies show that it's about 10 breaks per cell per S phase, so these breaks do occur. Breaks may result after trying to replicate past a single-stranded break, but they most often and usually occur when you're trying to replicate past a DNA damage, and you're asking, what is DNA damage? So DNA damage can be a damaged base, it can be an AP or abasic site, so I'll be getting into these later, but an apurinic or apyrimidinic site, or an abasic site is essentially a site that's missing a base. Or it can even be cross-linking of a protein to DNA. All of these can be DNA damage. And the image that I just showed you showed a break in the single-stranded DNA during replication. And this isn't very likely since there's very little single-stranded DNA that's exposed during replication. A more likely event is that you have some kind of lesion on DNA. So for example, you have a protein cross-linked to DNA. And we'll think about this as kind of like a train running into a giant boulder on the tracks. So when you have a protein cross-linked to DNA, and this can be caused by ionizing radiation, I know we talk a lot about ionizing radiation causing double-stranded DNA breaks, but ionizing radiation can also cross-link a protein that's bound to DNA. So when the replication machinery is coming through, you have this big lesion on the DNA. This causes a real problem. When it runs into it, it can lead to a double-stranded break. And this is really a more likely event rather than the single-stranded DNA, which I showed you previously. And it's important to note for some of the anti-cancer drugs, specifically the capsaicin family, the drug topotecan. It's a topo 1 poison, and what it does is it works by trapping topoisomerase to the DNA in a covalent intermediate. So this is very similar to a protein being cross-linked to DNA, and again, when cells go through S phase, you get the replication machinery coming through, and again, it's like a train hitting a giant boulder, and it leads to double-stranded breaks, and this is a really a huge problem. So now when you talk about these lesions on DNA, well, can we bypass this DNA, can the replication fork bypass this DNA damage? And the answer is yes, and we have evolved mechanisms to do so, and I'm going to go through a couple of those now. So for the first mechanism, it's called template switch, and keep that in mind, template switch, it'll give you a hint as to what it really is. So there's two different pathways that this can occur, and I'll go over this left one first. So this is just a general depiction of the replication fork, and think of the red as newly synthesized DNA. And you have this circle here, which is the lesion on the DNA. So you're getting replication going, the replication machinery encounters this lesion, and it can't pass it. So you get this stalling event. This then causes the auxiliary proteins that are associated with the replication fork to start looking for homology-associated proteins. these homology-associated proteins, now start looking for a region of DNA that has homology to this one here. Once it finds it, and in both of these cases, it uses the sister nascent strand as its homologous counterpart. So once it finds homology, its base pairs, it starts to replicate a little bit further, just enough for it to get past that lesion. You then get the undoing of the base pairing and re-annealing to the parental strands, and this now you have bypassed and replicated past that lesion. So another mechanism, the exact same setup, what can happen is if it runs into a lesion, you get this pausing event again, but the parental strand, it can actually, the replication fork can actually work to regress, and what happens is you get re-annealing of the parental strands, and this works to extrude the two newly synthesized DNA strands. So now this is really convenient for the strand. It can now use its sister nascent strand as a template. It can replicate a little bit further. Once it does that, these can then snap back. You can get re-annealing, and now you have successfully bypassed that lesion, and you can continue replicating. Now, I told you to keep in mind template switch, because if you think about it, these both are switching the template from where you are synthesizing the DNA, hence template switch. So this is one of the ways that you can bypass a lesion on DNA. Another way is a mutagenic or non-mutagenic bypass synthesis. This really just depends on the lesion that's in the DNA. But as you get replication complex coming through, it encounters the lesion, and in this case, the lesion is a thymine dimer. So once it incurs this, it can't pass it, so you get a stalling or a pausing event. Once this occurs, you then can get recruitment of other proteins, and in this case, you get recruitment of translesion polymerases. So translesion polymerases, they don't really synthesize DNA terribly processively. They have no proofreading activity. They can synthesize longer stretches of DNA, but they tend not to do so. But they all have the unique ability to synthesize DNA across from a lesion, even if it can't read the lesion. So the two translesion polymerases that they have here are Pol Zeta and Pol Eta in blue. So for example, if Pol Eta gets access to the template, it comes in, and even if it can't read this lesion, it's going to incorporate two adenines or two A's. So it regardless of what the lesion is, if it can't read it, it incorporates two A's. And this is true for all translesion synthesis polymerases. They all have their preferential nucleotides that they insert if they cannot read the lesion on the DNA. So these are called tolerance pathways, and this is really important because you're not fixing the damage in the DNA, right? You're just getting by it for now. If we think about it, the replication fork does not want to stop at every single little lesion and repair it before it can progress in replication. So this is allowing the progression of the replication fork so that repair can take care of it after, so it's not stopping at every single little lesion. So this is called tolerance because you're going on without repairing the damage that's done to the DNA. So now that I've talked about it, I will show you in a visual form the switch between a replicative polymerase and a translesion synthesis polymerase. So for the TLS polymerase, you have your normal replicative polymerase in green, PCNA, its processivity factor along with it. Once it encounters that lesion, the star on the DNA, again, you're getting that pausing event, and this causes a recruitment of different proteins. In this case, you're getting a recruitment of Rad6, Rad18. And how Rad6, Rad18 works is it specifically and uniquely monoubiquinates PCNA. Once it does this, PCNA then works to recruit and switch to a translesion polymerase. So once it switches, the translesion polymerase can take over. It'll synthesize past that lesion. And then after it synthesizes past that lesion, it can then switch back to a replicative polymerase. So this is just to give you a general idea of the different DNA polymerases that we have. So for a really long time, it was believed that we only had these five polymerases up top here. So Pol Alpha, Pol Beta, Pol Gamma, Pol Delta, and Pol Epsilon. So Pol Alpha is really important because you can't synthesize DNA de novo. You need a short primer to get replication going. So Pol Alpha lays down that short primer. It starts with RNA and then elongates it with DNA, and then it hands it off to either Pol Delta or Pol Epsilon. And Pol Delta and Pol Epsilon are the two replicative enzymes that synthesize the vast majority of the genome. So Pol Delta, and these are very similar, differing just a little bit in their fidelity. And Pol Delta, if we look at lagging strand synthesis, DNA repair, or if the replication fork encounters some kind of a problem, Pol Delta is usually recruited in after that. Then you have Pol Epsilon, which is the leading strand synthesis, and again, these two are very similar. Again, the two eukaryotic DNA polymerases that synthesize the vast majority of the genome in eukaryotes. So translation synthesis polymerases haven't been discovered until the past 20-25 years, and this is just showing you the the polymerases that now can be added to this five list. So if you notice, Pol Eta, which we talked about, which incorporates those two adenines or two A's across any lesion, and its proposed function in bypassed UV lesions. And Pol Zeta was the other one, which is the other translesion polymerase, again, bypass synthesis. So we've now discovered multiple different polymerases, and they have roles in multiple different functions. Non-homologous end joining, we'll be talking about a little bit later. Basic scission repair, which we kind of covered a little bit, just in the introduction. So this is really just to give you an idea of the different DNA polymerases that we have to date. So now that I've talked about errors in DNA replication itself, I'm really going to go into the biochemical process. And this is really an example of spontaneous damage that isn't a result of metabolism per se, but it's a direct result of the biochemistry of DNA itself. So one of the spontaneous reactions that can occur within our cell, and it does on a daily basis, is deprionation. So in orange here we have our sugar phosphate backbone, and in green we have our base, which in this case is guanine. So again, this is a spontaneous reaction. So how this works is water comes in, you then get spontaneous deprionation, and what you're left with is an AP site where you have just phosphate sugar backbone and you have now gotten rid of your base. So again, spontaneous reaction. It occurs up to 10,000 times in a cell per day for purine bases. And it only occurs about 500 times, so a lot less for pyrimidine bases in a cell per day. And I said it creates abasic sites or an AP site. Again, this is the sugar phosphate backbone that's missing the base. And this is really a problem, even though it's non-coding. This can block replication if it's not repaired. If you don't have a base there, you can't synthesize a base according to that, and you can't continue. So this is truly a problem, so you need to take care of this. It is very important to note that depurination happens in every cell of your body every day. So this is, it's not caused by any outside sources, and this is really just a normal chemical decay reaction that occurs on a daily basis. Another type of spontaneous chemical reaction that occurs naturally in your DNA is deamination, so the removal of an amine group. So what you have, for a couple of examples, cytosine, when it deaminates, it turns into a uracil, and this is pre-mutagenic because uracil is recognized as a T in replication. So you're getting a C to T mutation, so then this will cause issues with future rounds of replication because now this is going to base pair with an A rather than a G, which it should have originally. Then you have adenine. When it depurinates, it becomes hypoxanthine. For guanine, when it deaminates, it becomes xanthine. And we have pathways to remove both of these, and I'll be going over those in a little bit. And then finally, 5-methylcytosine. So it's important to note that there are multiple ways that methyl groups get added on to DNA bases. And these can be both intentionally or unintentionally, and some are good and some are bad. So we have a 5-methylcytosine, so when this deaminates, it now is recognized as a thymine. And again, this is pre-mutagenic because we again have a C to T mutation. This is now going to pair with an A, and this is pre-mutagenic because it's going to cause issues for future rounds of replication. So now that we talked about spontaneous things that are happening, this is more of a natural result of metabolism. So this is oxidation. Oxidation is a result of living in an oxidative oxygen environment, undergoing oxidative respiration that really cannot be avoided. So oxidation causes the creation of two different reactive oxygen species, and these are hydrogen peroxide as well as oxygen free radicals. So these may arise from mitochondrial action alone on itself. It may arise also from peroxisomes or inflammation, and this is important because these cells release oxidative damage as a killing mechanism. So it's really worth noting that recently a lot has been made of using free radical scavengers as a possible prevention of oxidative damage and prevention of cancer, such as vitamin E or high levels of vitamin C. And it's been shown that these really do not have any effect when it comes to cancer. And if we keep in mind, you cannot stop oxidation. So it can damage DNA bases, it causes oxidized bases, you can form abasic sites, so those AP sites, and also can cause DNA breaks. And interestingly, in a large recent clinical study, they compared people that routinely took vitamin E to those that did not, and the results showed that the people that routinely took vitamin E actually had a significantly shorter lifespan, a couple years, to those that didn't. There's an unknown reason, there wasn't really one main cause of death, but again, this is really just keeping in mind that balance, right? So oxidation, we can't avoid it. It's going to cause damage. We just need to make sure that we have the appropriate repair mechanisms working to repair that damage that's caused. So now I've talked about oxidation, I'll go over two examples. So you have a deoxyguanosine, and when this is oxidized, it becomes an 8-oxo-deoxyguanosine. And this is one of the more common events, and we do have a pathway to eliminate this. And then also we have a deoxy-5-methylcytosine. And when this is oxidized, it causes this intermediate, which spontaneously deaminates. And then we have a deoxythymidine glycol, or a DTG, or a T-glycol. And we also have a pathway to eliminate this as well. And I'll be going over both of those in a little bit. So another normal cellular process that occurs is methylation. We already kind of brought this up. But for methylation, we have these enzymes, methylases. And methylases can methylate DNA, and in doing so, it's working to regulate the DNA as well as islands of genes. Methylases, there's also enzymes or methylases that are specific to methylating proteins. And sometimes these methylates can act inappropriately on DNA and methylate DNA, so now you have methylation in places we don't want methylation. This can really be a problem. So these are just a couple of the examples are some of the hotspots for this methylation, and these are in brown, and the darker brown being the more common, and the two that I will be talking about. So you have a 3-methyladenine, which is a hotspot for methylation, and also a 7-methylguanine. And it's important to note, again, it's a normal cellular process, so there's up to 7,000 per cell in a day. So now that I've talked about endogenous damages, so damage coming from within the cell, I'm now going to talk about exogenous damage, so damage coming from outside the cell. So exogenous damage examples are ultraviolet radiation, alkylating agents, and there are various sorts, and they occur routinely within both the plant and animal world, and also X-rays, so ionizing radiation, which we also touched upon as well. So it causes double-stranded breaks, and it also can work to cross-link a protein that is bound to DNA. So I'll begin by going over solar UV radiation. So the different types of UV ultraviolet radiation are UVA, UVB, and UVC. UVC being the most dangerous, but fortunately it's very effectively blocked by the ozone layer, and this is why people are so concerned about the ozone layer and pollution. We also have UVB, and most people don't really worry about this one too much. So it does cause skin cancer, cataracts, as well as sunburn. And then we have UVA, which is the least harmful, if you'd like to think of it that way, out of the different UV types. And this causes premature aging, wrinkling of the skin. But it's important to note it also does cause skin cancer, but at a much slower rate than UVB and UVC. And this has really become a growing problem with tanning beds. So tanning beds often use these UVB-free light bulbs. So tanning beds are not as good as they think they are at separating or segregating UVA from UVB. And even UVA on itself also has been shown to cause skin cancer. So this has really been a growing problem. And it's been shown that skin cancer rates are rising within people in their early 20s, especially in the U.S. and United Kingdom, where tanning beds are very popular. So this is really a huge problem. So two major types of UV damage that can occur. So you can get cyclobutane pyrimidine dimers, or CPDs, and these are very similar to thymine dimers. So it's important to note, and especially when we're talking about NER, these work to distort the DNA helicase 30 degrees. And this, again, will be important when we're talking about NER, but just important to keep in mind for now. Another type of damage that can occur is a pyrimidine-pyrimidone photoproduct, or a 6-4 photoproduct or photoadduct. And this is much more bulkier. So this distorts the helix 44 degrees. And again, this distortion will become important when we're talking about NER later, but just keep that in mind for now. So a couple of different pyrimidine dimers can occur. So the most common is thymine dimers. The second most common is a cytosine thymine dimer. And the least common is a cytosine dimer. So it's important to note that the least common cytosine dimers are the most mutagenic out of these. And the thymine dimers, which are the most common, are the least mutagenic and best repaired. And if we think about that, with the thymine dimers being the most common, we have evolved better repair mechanisms to take care of these over time, and this is really why this is the least mutagenic. So for squamous cell carcinomas, it's been shown that the incidence rate doubles every 10-degree decline in latitude towards the equator. And it really peaks at the equator where the cumulative UV is the highest, and this makes sense because you're getting the most exposure to UV radiation. So now I'm going to talk about DNA alkylating agents because a lot of these are addressed by the same pathways that the UV photoadducts are addressed by. So many of these are cytotoxics, mutagens, or carcinogens. And it really just depends on how much damage that they cause. So some of these agents are used in the laboratory. I'm sure some of you have heard of them. MMS, methyl methane sulfonate, or ENU, ethyl nitrosourea. They're also cytotoxic drugs that we use for chemotherapy, such as these two, and that topo-1 poison that we talked about earlier also falls into this category. There are also environmental agents, also methyl chloride and streptozotocin. So it's important to note that microorganisms produce these DNA alkylating agents as a type of defense for combating other microorganisms. So these are just two examples here, but there are various others. And again, it's an important role in their survival and defense against other microorganisms. So just like the other, we have some hot spots for DNA alkylation. And I won't go over all of these, and you're not going to have to know all of these. But it's important to note that for MMS, you have the dark green or dark brown indicating a hot spot for N7 guanine, N3 adenine, and also N7 adenine. So for ENU, this is really important as well. It's one of its hotspots are actually within the DNA backbone, so that's a problem within itself. Also, it shares a hotspot N7 guanine, as well as an O6 guanine as well. So those are just some of the three top hallmarks sites for DNA alkylation for both those agents. So now that I've showed you some of the hotspots, we'll talk about some of the impacts that DNA alkylation has on the DNA. So 7-methylguanine is very unstable. It spontaneously depurinates at a very rapid rate, and this works to cause an A-base site. As we talked, this is a site missing a base, and this really causes an issue. It blocks replication and can be cytotoxic if it's not repaired. Also, 3-methyladenine works to block replication, and again, cytotoxic if it's not repaired. And then finally, you have a 6-ethylguanine, which is mutagenic but not cytotoxic. So it mispairs with TN replication, which causes a mutation, but again, it's important to note it's not cytotoxic. So these are just some of the alkylating agents. There are many more, and they all differ in their biological effects. So now I'm going to talk about another excision repair pathway, and I'm going to talk about base excision repair. And when we talk about base excision repair, when we take all the repair pathways together, if we were to knock out base excision repair, this would be the most lethal. This just really shows you the importance of base excision repair. So there are many variations, and it really depends on the nature of the DNA damage, as well as the glycosylase. So the glycosylase, there's a family of them, and the glycosylase in BER is what really recognizes the damage. And it also depends on the nature of the polymerase. So all base excision repair follow these steps here. So again, you have the glycosylase that identifies the damage and works to remove the incorrect base. And this works to create an AP site. So now that we've talked about the AP sites before, AP site repair can really just jump into this pathway right here now that we have an AP site created. So now you have an AP endonuclease that works to nick the 5' side of that AP site. And this generates a 3' hydroxyl terminus. So now you can get extension of that 3' hydroxyl terminus by DNA polymerase, which replaces the AP site with the correct nucleotide. So you've removed the inaccurate base, and now you've put in the correct nucleotide, hopefully. You then can get ligation of the DNA nick. And again, this is just the basic steps, and I really like to think of base excision repair and its role as taking care of the lesions that are the most highly evolved, the most common, and are a result of both spontaneous as well as metabolic processes. And again, that was just a general skeleton of the pathway. So now that I've talked about it, I want to give you a visual idea of how this works. So you have a uracil incorporated, and uracil is obviously not supposed to be in the DNA, so we want to get rid of that. So a uracil DNA glycosylase recognizes this damage and works to remove that inaccurate base. Once it cleaves off that base, you're now left with the sugar phosphate backbone and the creation of an AP site now. So it's important to note that some glycosylases have their own AP lyase activity, and others rely on an independent AP lyase for this. So in this case, you have an AP site that is recognized by the AP lyase. You get that 5' cut in the sugar phosphate backbone, You now have a 3' hydroxyl terminus, which can be extended. You can get the incorporation of the proper nucleotide, and then you can get ligation to fix this problem. So I only talked about uracil DNA glycosylases, but there are many. As I said, there's a whole family of them. And again, it's important to note that some have their own AP lyase activity, while others rely on an independent AP lyase to take care of that AP site that's created. And as you can see, they have multiple different targets that range from mismatches to deamination events to methylation to oxidation, all of these things. And it's really important to note that BER is a major processing pathway for fixing DNA damage that's caused by both spontaneous and endogenous sources that are results of metabolism. So now that we know BER is very important, we want to know, does BER result in cancer if it's not working? So we have mute YH, which was only discovered within the last couple of years, and this was the first BER gene that has been associated with a human cancer syndrome. So mute YH works to excise an A across from an 8-oxo-GA base pair. So biallelic germline mutations, which to know are often pretty rare, work to predispose the person to colorectal adenomas as well as carcinomas. It's also important to note that MeatYH has been shown to associate with these different proteins, and this really suggests that it's active at the replication, replicating foci. It's also important to note that there's a recessive form of familial adenomatosis polyposis, and this is really the first example of BER being involved in cancer. So now I'm going to talk about direct repair, which is also called direct reversal of damage, and the reason why is direct repair works by directly reversing the damage that is caused, as the name implies. So in textbooks, the most common example of this is photolyse and E. coli. So photolyse is an enzyme that works by storing all the DNA in visible, all the energy in visible light. It takes that energy and it works to separate thymine dimers into individual thymines through a process called photoreactivation. Now, photolyse is in some animals as well as plants, but humans don't have photolyse. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples of enzymes that work via direct repair in humans. And these enzymes are DNA alkyl transferases. So this is one example, O6-alpha-1 DNA alkyl transferase. Again, these work by directly reversing the damage that is caused on the DNA. And for the second one, I'm going to go through the whole process. So you have alkylase B or ALK-B. So you have 3-methylcytosine, as we've seen before. ALK-B works to recruit alpha-ketoglutarate as well as oxygen and creates byproducts of succinate and carbon dioxide. And it leaves you with this intermediate here. So what happens is you get the spontaneous, you get the removal of that formaldehyde, and now what you're left is the cytosine. So you're directly removing the methyl that was added to that DNA. So it's important to note that these work via direct repair by directly reversing the damage that has been done to the DNA. It's important to note that this is a very common form of damage, and this is why we've evolved a specific enzyme to take care of this, is because it's very common. So now I'm going to be talking about the last excision repair pathway, which is nucleotide excision repair. So it fixes a wide variety of DNA damage, and it's usually UV and bulky adducts that work to distort the DNA helicase. And this is really where that distortion earlier from thymine dimers as well as 6-4 photoadducts come into play. So NER, how it works is it recognizes a kink or distortion in the DNA helix. So for those thymine dimers, as I said, it only caused a 30-degree kink in the DNA helix. So NER can work on thymine dimers, but it's more likely that NER, and it's been shown that NER is more important in taking care of the more bulky 6-4 photoproducts that cause a larger distortion in the DNA helix. So now this is the 6 basic steps of NER. So in all organisms, NER involves these following steps. So you get damage recognition, and this isn't a specific recognition of the damage. It is a recognition of the distortion of the backbone of the helicase, or helix, you get recruitment and binding of multiple protein complexes at the damage site. You then get a double incision. So you get an incision on both the 5' and 3' ends of the lesion, and they're usually far away from each other, the incision sites. You get removal of the damage containing DNA strands from between the two nicks, so you get a removal of the lesion. You then get gap filling by DNA Pol Delta, and then you can get ligation of the nick in the DNA. So in humans, we have two types of nucleotide excision repair. One being global nucleotide excision repair, so this works on both DNA strands except actively transcribed strands. You also have transcription coupled nucleotide excision repair, and this works only on actively transcribed DNA strands. But the pathways for these two are very similar, as you'll see in a couple minutes when I go over them. So I'm going to start off by going over global genome NER. So there's a lot of different proteins being brought in here. It's not important that you remember the names, but I will ask you to remember and note that a lot of these proteins start with XP, and that'll come into play a couple of slides. So you have your damage that causes a distortion in the DNA helicase. This is recognized by the NER proteins. So you get a recruitment of XPE and DDP1. This then causes further recruitment of more proteins, such as TF2H, which is a transcription factor. And as part of this complex, you have XPB and XPD, which are two ATP-dependent helicases. So with the addition of ATP, you get the helicases unwinding that double-stranded DNA. You then get recruitment of XPA, RPA, again, XPD, a lot of proteins that start with XP, XPC, as well as others. So once this occurs, you then, again, get more recruitment of even more XPF proteins, ERCC1, and then you finally get a double incision. So again, you get an incision on the 5' end of the lesion as well as the 3' end. So you make two nicks in the DNA. Once the nicks are made, the helicases work to continue unwinding the double-stranded DNA, and this works to pop off that DNA that contains the lesion. Once this is off, you now have a gap that needs to be filled. So you're going to recruit in your applicative polymerase as well as the cofactors it needs, so polymerase delta, PCNA, RSC, and DNA ligase to ligate those nicks after the gap has been filled. So it's really important to note that there is an advantage to the non-specificity that we're seeing here. It doesn't necessarily recognize the lesion itself, it recognizes the kink that's caused and the distortion that's caused. So if an unknown alkylating agent comes in on one strand of the DNA, it can be removed without a specific recognition. Now to go over transcriptionally coupled NER, which is very similar, it just differs in this step here. So it's important to note that transcription-coupled NER, as the name implies, only occurs on actively transcribed strands of DNA. So you have your RNA polymerase helical enzyme coming in. It recognizes that lesion or the distortion caused in the DNA. You get a recruitment of the same proteins, TF2H, that transcription factor. Again, the helicases work in the same manner to unwind the DNA. You get further recruitment of more XP proteins, XPA, XPG, as well as RPA to coat that single-stranded DNA. And the final steps of NER for the transcription coupled is the exact same as your global or genome. So you're getting more recruitment of your XP proteins, XPF, and this leads to, again, your double incision on both the 5' end and the 3' end of your lesion. The helicases work to pop off that piece of DNA that contains your lesion. You then have gap filling, much like you've seen before, the exact same process of what we just saw. It's important to note that the same basic process also occurs in E. coli, although it's a more simple pathway and fewer proteins are involved. So I asked you to keep in mind that all these proteins are starting with XP, and this slide really describes why I told you to keep those in mind. So XP, as you all know probably, is xeroderma pigmentosa. So patients with XP have increased skin damage due to sunlight. And they also have a very high incidence rate of skin cancer. So UV light, as we've seen, causes damage, bulky adducts and damage to the DNA, as we've seen in the previous slides. So XP patients, if genes are mutated for these XP proteins in the NER pathway, such that these proteins lose their function, you no longer have NER functioning and you cannot fix these photoadducts that are caused by UV damage. So usually patients with XP wear hats and tend not to go outside to expose themselves to UV damage. And usually these patients can live fairly long lives. And this is just severe cases of the damage shown here. So not all of them look like this either. But the important thing to note here is when you knock out NER, you still have Pol Eta. And Pol Eta is that translesion polymerase that can incorporate 2As across from any lesion. So even with the function of Pol Eta, you are no longer able to compensate and repair these UV adducts that are caused. So again, this is really just keeping in mind that balance. So when you get rid of NER, you're increasing the mutation rate without increasing the repair rate to compensate for those, and this is what causes the syndrome. So as we touched upon briefly before, double-strand breaks I will now talk about as well. So unrepaired double-strand breaks are lethal or mutagenic. The sources that can cause these are X-rays, chemicals, free radicals, and as we saw, replication across from a single-stranded break. So double-stranded breaks trigger the recruitment of repair factors, and the repair of double-stranded breaks can be either homology-directed or end-joining. And I'll talk about both of those briefly in a little bit. So for double-stranded breaks, they work by triggering cell cycle arrest via checkpoint kinase ATM, and I'll talk about this as well in a little bit in a couple of slides. But the take-home message for this really is double-stranded breaks lead to genomic instability. So if you're getting a lot of double-stranded breaks, you're going to get a lot of non-homologous directed repair, and this can lead to translocations, and as we know, translocations are a characteristic of cancer. So this pathway is really truly important and plays a huge role in that. So double-strand break repair is essential for all cells and genome stability. There are multiple pathways to deal with this, and I'll talk about all three of these. So you have double-strand break repair by homologous recombination, you have double-strand break repair by non-homologous end joining, and you also have a non-ligatable single-strand break repair. So I'm going to start off with homologous recombination, and I'm not going to go into the whole pathway, as I'm sure at some point in your classes, whether it was genetics or biochemistry, you guys have seen homologous repair and Holly junctions and all that stuff. But I will remind you that this is really a facilitation of homology searching by in E. coli, either RecA, or in eukaryotes by Rad51. So what happens is you have a single strand of DNA. It gets interacts with these, or gets coded with these different proteins. They then work to search for homology in a separate template. You then get base pairing, and then recombination can occur. So it's important to note in eukaryotes, the proteins that are important in this process include Rad51, which you mentioned here, Rad52, Rad54, 55, 57, and 59. Also, it's been shown that BRCA1 mediates homologous recombination, and Rad52 and BRCA2 interact with Rad51. So now these are highlighted in red because BRCA1 and BRCA2, as you all know, are hot players in breast cancer. And BRCA2 specifically is also a main player in a very aggressive form of prostate cancer as well. So this is really just indicating to you, once you get some kind of mutation that messes with the function of these proteins, this repair pathway is just so important that once you get loss of function for these, this will increase your chances in the prevalence to cancer. So I'm going to start off by talking about the homology-directed repair pathways, and there are two forms. So the first form is non-mutagenic. So this is synthesis-dependent strand annealing to fix a double-strand break, and this requires Rad51, Rad52, and the mediator proteins Rad54, 55, and 57. The second form is a mutagenic form, and this is single-strand annealing. So this occurs at repeated DNA sequences, and it only requires Rad52 and 59, so it requires a lot less proteins as well. So I'm going to briefly talk about these and explain why one is mutagenic and one is not. So synthesis-dependent strand annealing, if you remember from the previous slide, is a homology-driven repair that is non-mutagenic or error-free. So you have a double-strand break. You get the recruitment of homology-associated proteins that search for that homologous region within another template. You get a 5' to 3' resection. You get strand evasion once it finds that homology. You can then get new DNA synthesis off that homologous template. Once this occurs, you then can get unwinding from the template and annealing, and then you can get ligation. So this is a non-mutagenic form because you have no mutations, you're not losing any DNA through this repair pathway. Now for single-strand annealing, which was the mutagenic form of homology-driven repair, as it said, occurs where you have repeated genes or repeated sequences. So for this side, this is an example of repeated genes. So these are the two areas of homology here. And you have a double-strand break right in the middle of them. So again, you're also getting resection, but what happens is you get a direct annealing of those two regions of homology. Once that occurs, you then can get flap removal and ligation. So it's important to note that you do get a deletion, and this is why this is a mutagenic form. It just really depends where within the DNA that this occurs. But it also is important to note that there is some mutagenesis here, but you don't tend to get translocation. So again, this may or may not be mutagenic, just depending on where this occurs in the DNA. So now to go over the non-homology driven or non-homologous. So non-homologous end joining. You're not going to need to know all the names of these proteins, just understand the basic concept here. So you have a double-stranded break. The ends are recognized by two. These ends can also be recognized by MRE, as well as ATM can be recruited, and we'll be talking about that in a little bit. But for now, Ku binds these ends. Ku then works to recruit DNA PK. So DNA PK is one of the three major kinases involved in the DNA damage response. DNA PK works the juxtaposition of these ends. You get other recruitment of other proteins, and you get this end processing that occurs, and then you get the direct annealing of those two ends together. So you do lose some DNA. But it's more important that if you get a lot of non-homologous end joining occurring at a lot of double-stranded breaks, translocation is going to occur, and this is really a hallmark of cancer arising. So there are inherited predispositions to cancer. So ATM and MRE11, when you get a mutation in these, so ATM is also another major kinase in the DNA damage response pathway. And MRE11 is part of the complex that recognizes double-strand breaks for ATM. MBS1 is also part of this complex with MRE11 that recognizes those double-strand breaks. BRCA1 and BRCA2, again, play a role in breast cancer, and BRCA2 specifically plays a role in an aggressive form of prostate cancer. And you also have different helicases that, when they have mutations in them, also can lead to cancer. So again, when you get any kind of mutations in these genes, you have a predisposition to cancer. Notably, ATM and MRE11 mutations are often rare. So for all of these, a lot of these mutations are null mutations, embryonic lethal, except ATM. So if you get a loss of any of the functions of these proteins, you're going to result in a gross chromosomal rearrangement, which is a real problem. And I'm going to put this up here just to really connect DNA repair damage with cancer. So as I said, if you lose any of these proteins and the function of these proteins, you're going to lose double-strand break repair process, and again, this is going to lead to cancer, just keeping in mind that idea of balance. So if you have an ATM loss of function, you have an AT syndrome, MRE11, AT-like disorder, BRCA1 and BRCA2, breast cancer as we had described. Your helicases here, if you get mutations in those, they also cause a syndrome. But the take-home message for this slide really is, when you lose any of the function of these proteins that are important for this repair process, you're now working to shift that balance. So you're decreasing the repair rate, and you're not changing the mutation rate, decreasing it to compensate for it, so now you're getting a shift towards cancer. And it really just shows you the importance of double-strand break repair for ourselves and for us. So now I'm going to go over the DNA damage response as it heavily intersects with DNA repair. So for the DNA damage response, you have three major kinases that come into play. ATM, as we touched on before, ATR, which is an ATM-like kinase, and then DNA PK, which we also have talked about. So it's important to note that these are the three major kinases, and they really work by phosphorylation events as well as signaling cascades to either arrest the cell cycle so that the DNA can be repaired, or they directly are involved in the DNA repair process itself. So for the paper that I had you guys read for today, it had a really nice figure that kind of outlined the main take-home points for the DNA damage response. So figure one. So you have some kind of damage here, and this works in this case to activate ATM or ATR. And through phosphorylation or a signaling cascade, you're getting different events, different consequences for that. So such as apoptosis if the damage cannot be fixed, cell cycle arrest, allowing for that DNA damage to occur, or they can be involved in DNA repair themselves. So for the next one, figure two also really outlines different pathways that can be activated when these different kinases are involved and activated themselves. So for figure two, if you have a double-stranded break, this is recognized and it works to activate either ATM or DNA PK. And as we just went over, when DNA PK is activated, it takes part in non-homologous end joining. When ATM is activated, it can phosphorylate CHEK2. This causes a cell cycle arrest, and this allows for the DNA to be repaired. ATM can also decrease the levels of CDK. This works to increase BRCA2 and RAN51, and this leads to the activation of homologous recombination, which we have also looked at. Now, when you have a single-stranded break, this is recognized and activates ATR. So So ATR works by phosphorylating another CHECK protein, CHECK1, and again it works to cell cycle arrest and allowing that DNA to be repaired if it can be. It also can activate the 9-11 complex, so this works by activating those TLF polymerases so that we can bypass that damage. It also can phosphorylate the Fanconi anemia protein, which works to increase BRCA1 activation, and then this also leads to homologous recombination. So again, this works. These proteins work by phosphorylation events as well as signaling cascades, and they can cause the direct arrest of the cell cycle, allowing the cell, if it can, to repair the DNA damage that has been done, or they can be directly involved in the repair themselves, such as DNA PK, which we just saw. Now, I was told that you guys are going to have a lecture on P53, but just to give you kind of a little bit teaser, and I'm sure most of you have already heard about P53, ATM works to phosphorylate P53 as well. So P53 is a tumor suppressor protein, and it's a major transcriptional regulator as well. So it's involved in both DNA repair as well as the DNA damage responses you see here. It's been shown to interact with a wide variety of DNA repair proteins, and it's also been shown to modulate their functions. Also, it's one of the master regulators of the DNA damage response pathway. So just to give you guys a little bit of a starter, if you guys are indeed having this lecture, so in normal cells, P53 is kept at very low levels. So although it's kept at low levels, P53 is actually synthesized at a high rate. It's actually targeted for degradation by its partner, MDM2, and it's targeted for degradation through polyubiquitination events. So in normal cells, P53 is low. So different stresses or things can occur, and in this case, I'll be focusing on DNA damage. When DNA damage occurs, you get P53 at high levels. And well, how does this occur? Well, ATM and CHECK2, which is the protein that it phosphorylates, work to phosphorylate both MDM2 as well as P53. This phosphorylation event inhibits their interaction. Therefore, P53 cannot be targeted for degradation, and P53 levels rise. P53 can then work to increase the levels of P21, and P21 works to block the cell cycle either at G1S or G2M. Now, if the damage persists for a really long time, what can happen is you can get the increase in the expression of apoptotic proteins as well, such as BAX. And then the cell really reaches this critical decision point. Now, can we fix the damage that has been done, or should we just become apoptotic, therefore we don't become cancerous? So as a take-home message for this part of the lecture, as well as kind of the whole lecture loss of mutagenesis of P53 really has a devastating dual consequence. One being that it prevents the cell cycle arrest due to DNA damage, and this just leads to an increasing amount of damage that's caused. And second, it also prevents apoptosis of cells, which have accumulated too much damage and that should apoptose because they become cancerous. So these two effects really lead directly to the genomic instability that we've been talking about, and this really explains why P53 is most commonly a mutated protein in all human tumors. And again, a just take-home message for this lecture, I guess, is that idea of balance. Right? So you need to keep in mind the mutation rate as well as the repair rate. We can have mutations in our DNA, but we need to make sure that we can compensate for these mutations with the appropriate repair mechanisms. So with that, I'm going to end here, and I will take any questions that you guys have. You don't have to clap.